The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for April 27th, 2017, the one-page tax plan edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine joins me yon and beyond from New Haven. Hello, Emily.
Except I'm not in New Haven. I'm in Brooklyn. But hello. Oh,
that's even better. Hello, Brooklyn Bazelon. And sitting across from me at the Slate DC Studio HQ is John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Hello, John.
Hello, David. Hello, Emily.
Hello.
And John, can we say that you're interviewing the president on Saturday? Are you excited about that?
Yes, you can say it. And yes, I'm excited about it. And I'm just going to say yes.
Good luck. May it go well. On this week's Gabfest, in fact, the reason why John is interviewing the president, it's the Donald Trump's 100 days in office. It arrives with a new Trump care plan and a new extremely, extremely short tax plan. My third grader writes essays that are longer than that tax plan and more detailed. Do either of those new grand schemes have a shot? Then President Obama has decided to take $400,000 from a Wall Street firm to give a speech. The correct response to that, I think, is oy. We will talk about we'll talk about that. Then yet another Trump immigration order is blocked by yet another judge. Will it hold up? Plus, we'll have cocktail chatter. And in Slate Plus, I think we're going to Slate Plus, what conspiracy theory do you believe to be true? Or what conspiracy theory do we believe to be true? If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to get it. Two key announcements. We have two live shows coming up. One on Wednesday, May 10th here in Washington, D.C. Very soon at the Warner Theater. There's still some tickets available. It's going to be a great show. It will be great in part because Evan McMullen is going to join us as a special guest. Evan McMullen, the conservative presidential candidate and an eloquent anti-Trump conservative, is going to be with us on stage. So please go to slate.com/live to get tickets for that show. We want to see you there. And then Colorado, June 7th, we have our first live show in Denver at the Robert and Judy Newman Center for the Performing Arts, Wednesday, June 7th. It's going to be awesome. Go to slate.com/live to join us for that show, too. Can't wait to see you there. 100 days down, only 1,300 or so to go. How many? 1,320, some number like that. The Trump administration has accomplished so little, yet exhausted us all so much. We have very few people nominated or in positions, the key 600 positions that the president has to fill. There's been no major legislation that has gotten through Congress. There's been a bunch of arm-waving executive orders. And of course, there's been Neil Gorsuch, which is an achievement any Republican president would be proud of. But come this week, there has been a frenzy to claim accomplishment and to actually rush through some accomplishment. So on Wednesday, we were introduced to a tax proposal that is shorter and sketchier than my introduction to this segment is. And then there's a new health care bill that is jacked up to please the House Freedom Caucus that is also potentially going to get pushed through the House. So, Emily, is 100 days a meaningful measure of anything? Should we care about it? Should we talk about it? Should we just pass that off and just talk about the tax plan and healthcare plan specifically?
Well, it comes from FDR because he passed a ton of New Deal legislation, really, you know, got rolling very quickly because, of course, he took office during the Great Depression. And so then we have
and had
it as
overwhelming
a convention.
Congressional majorities, which Donald Trump does not.
Precisely. And many other presidents since then have chafed at being judged by this standard. And of course, it's arbitrary. On the other hand, why not take stock? I mean, we're 3 months in and change. That seems like a decent enough moment to look back at the very beginning. It doesn't necessarily tell us what's going to come next, but, you know, whatever. So go arbitrary standards of measurement.
Also, Newt Gingrich and the 100 days of the 1995 Congress, 95-96 Congress, that kind of gave some more oomph to the 100-day thing. Plus, President Trump campaigned on a 100-day agenda when he was a candidate, and he raised the bar in terms of how much he was going to be able to achieve and how quickly throughout his campaign. You could argue it was one of the things he promised, that the normal torpid, slow, draggy pace of Washington and foreign policy would be quickened by him. It was a thing he promised, whether he was saying, I'm going to win so much you'll get tired of it, or we'll be able to beat ISIS quickly, or any of those things. His promises had a temporal element to them. I think it's useful in that regard, too, since he's one of the things he's come up against is he has moved incredibly quickly in some areas, and then obviously has not been able to move quickly in other areas.
Well, so Emily, by the standard that you set and by the standard that John set just now, has the Trump 100 days been successful for him?
I mean, he has Justice Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. That's a big accomplishment. It's an accident of timing. Obviously, if that vacancy hadn't been there when he started, that wouldn't have already taken place. But still, that goes in his win column. He has many executive orders, some of them, the major ones, I would argue, blocked by the courts. But some of the other ones are going to make big changes, or at least they seem like they're going to. The Justice Department, which is the part of the government I've been following the most closely, has been very busy and is making real changes in immigration enforcement, in enforcing criminal law, and a variety of other things. So I just think it's silly to say that he hasn't really done anything. I mean, the other thing I was really struck by was a column, I think, by Michael Grunwald in Politico about just all of the ways in which Trump is blowing through our norms that protect against corruption, have prevented presidents from being serial liars in the past, just all these things we've assumed no president would ever do. And I feel like I am getting numb to that because it's upsetting to watch. And it's important to remember how much has changed in 100 days simply on that front.
Well, can I just make the point that I make every single time that you talk about this, which is that yes, sure, the president has blown through these norms. Yes, the president has self-dealt and lied and you know, engaged in footsie with Russians during the campaign in ways that were alarming and possibly against the law. But it's because we have a Congress, a Republican majority in Congress that essentially refuses to investigate, hold him responsible, to say that these are serious matters, that's the problem. The problem is, of course, that Trump is doing it, but it's equally a problem that the institutions that exist in Washington to check the president and to hold him responsible, whoever he is, refuse to act in that way.
Yes, codependence, agreed.
Although they are acting at least in some little ways, which is to say, although this has been dropped a bit, but pushing a new round of sanctions to punish the Russians for interference in the election, that was something the president didn't want. They obviously stopped his health care plan at first. We'll see what happens at the end of this week. Your point, though, David, is right. And also on places like North Korea and Syria, there's been no assertion of anything other than sort of green room comments from most members of Congress. I mean, the president's being given full and free rein to operate in the foreign policy sphere, which is, some people would argue, well, that's what a president does, and that's part of the president's power. But there are members of Congress who, particularly again with the last president, bristled at the idea that the president was pulling in too much power into the executive, and they particularly did with executive orders. President Trump, as a candidate, was constantly claiming that executive orders were an abuse of the office, and he's now done a version of what President Obama did, which is when he's been stymied in the legislative, he's used executive orders to either do as much as he can or at least look like he's doing everything he can.
So, John, there are two big legislative measures that loom before Congress. Healthcare has zombie Trump care, as people are calling it, has reemerged, that there is a bill that seems to be making its way to the House that would take the AHCA and make it more palatable to the Freedom Caucus. It would allow states to opt out of required benefits. There would still be the guarantee for coverage for pre-existing conditions, but insurers would not be required to charge those people.
Basically, they can waive almost everything that's important about Obamacare and the comprehensive way it approaches healthcare coverage.
So you're right. So the argument from the Freedom Caucus is that the more mandates there are in the American healthcare plan that carry over from Obamacare, the higher the prices will be. If you lower the mandates, you'll have competition and freedom of activity by the insurers, and that'll drive down the cost. It's funny because that's essentially Paul Ryan's theory, but he just wants to keep more of the mandates than the Freedom Caucus wants. So the Freedom Caucus is saying basically leave it up to the states to decide how many mandates they want. And if other states want to keep it and keep their prices high, then they can do that, which sets up, if this were to pass, which there's some serious questions about that, not just in the House, but in the Senate, then it's really, it sets up some really interesting tension with the states, because you have states like Ohio and Michigan, states that that President Trump won, and where a lot of people who are who voted for President Trump benefit from either the Medicaid expansion or the Affordable Care Act. You know, there will be a tension between the governors and what they want to do and what presumably the president wants to do, which is removing the Affordable Care Act. But just one quick thing about the politics of this. I'm not quite sure why the last time the American Health Care Act died, it was because moderates were against it. So the Freedom Caucus has gotten a lot of attention here, but the problems that existed that caused moderates to not like it have not been fixed, near as I can tell. So I don't get why they would. And even let's say they go vote for it, the Senate's not going to like it. You know, a senator said to me, anything that passes because the Freedom Caucus in the House is not going to pass the Senate. So they're making the moderates take a walk for a bill that's not going to pass. So why would they do that? So it seems a little complicated. It seems a little unfinished to me.
Although if you're in the Freedom Caucus, it's great because you're no longer to blame and you shift the blame to the moderates. And if you're Paul Ryan, you might even shift the blame to the Senate.
It's just so appalling, though. I mean, this plan, what they would propose. First of all, let's not lose sight of the fact that the key element of this is a huge tax rebate for rich people. The rollback on taxes on high income people that help funds all these subsidies. So number one, it's a huge giveaway. The overwhelming majority of the tax gains will go to the extremely rich. That's number one. Number two, it's just massively going to screw over people with pre-existing conditions. And these are the people who we all know. Every one of us has someone in our family who has a pre-existing condition. And we all know that barring some protection, these people get completely screwed by a healthcare system that doesn't have basic protections built in. You know, the conservatives and the Republicans are kidding themselves if they think that this is an actually good policy solution to the problem they face. They know it will never pass. They don't actually want it. It's purely optical. It makes me sick. It really makes me sick. But John, so there's the healthcare plan, which you've talked a little bit about the politics of. Then there's this tax plan. So where is the energy for that coming from?
Primarily, it's coming from the president, who wants to show, despite having said the 100-day marker was phony, wants to show that he's in there swinging for his constituents. The way this looks like swinging for his constituents, and there's obviously a debate about who benefits from this tax plan if it were to pass, which is not going to. Basically, what he's saying is cut taxes, a lot of growth, that's going to help the economy. That's him in there fighting to give people tax cuts. And that is it's basically a campaign event. You talked about how undetailed the plan was. It reduces the tax rates from 7 to 3, but doesn't tell you where those rates kick in. It's a little bit specific about deductions, but not super specific about deductions. And it also obviously does not weigh in at all about the revenue effects or the effect of the deficit. The Committee for Responsible Budget says it'll, at best, in a best case scenario, will increase the debt by $5.5 trillion over 10 years. If this were to go forward, which it's not going to, but whatever tax.
Why is it not going to?
Because the things that they left out, the deficit effects, for example, are going to have to get. They're going to have to lower the deficit effects of whatever tax plan goes through. Also, border adjustment has been taken out, which is something that the House once believed in. I can't believe they'll just totally throw that overboard. And, you know, the lobbyists will get involved, and you have to pass it either with 60 votes in the Senate, which means it really won't pass, or you have to pass it through reconciliation in the Senate. And the reason you have to pass it with reconciliation is that that lowers the threshold to 50, but it will then only last for 10 years. There are people that believe that's a crazy way to make policy, and they will resist that. But that doesn't matter. For the purposes of this week, the president's able to say, I'm out here working really hard to try and reduce your taxes. And that's good for him in terms of sticking with his kind of core message.
But does that really not matter, John? I mean, it doesn't matter in this moment. I guess he can say at his 100-day mark, I'm cutting taxes mostly for really rich people. Oh, and by the way, some of these tax breaks will particularly benefit people like me. But even if he leaves off all of the snarky stuff I just said, in the longer term, if none of this goes anywhere, doesn't that matter more? Can I cling to that idea?
Well, no. But, well, who knows? Who knows where we are? I mean, the president's approval rating is below 40%, or is it about 40%? He is not, by traditional terms, in a healthy place for a president. So let's not lose sight of that context. Putting forward a plan that, that then never gets passed or that will not improve those numbers. So, so in a sense, you're right. But if something does get passed, it's much like his position on the border wall. I think there are a lot of people who believe that the border wall is not. It is not required that he have bricks all the way from one end of the country
to the
other.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor.
And it's a metaphor for security, and it's a metaphor for I'm out there pushing the envelope, and yeah, we may get less, but we only got what we got because I set the, you know, the marker way out here, and I was loud and proud about it and constant about it. And that for that, he gets credit from his voters, and this is the same kind of thing. If in the end it's not the what he put forward this week, but is a tax cut nevertheless, and brings in some of this money that's been overseas and makes the business folks happy, then that's a win, and people won't measure it against the original proposal.
So, John, you don't think that the Republicans, when given the chance to sort of grab the candy of having a huge tax cut and just sort of saying, okay, let's blow up the deficit, doesn't matter, we get to give the huge tax cut, we get to give a huge corporate tax cut, that there aren't enough of them to sort of say, let's just grab it because it's a win.
Well,
and we get to say that we've made a huge tax cut.
I don't know. I mean, so they want to cut taxes and have for a long time because they believe that increases economic growth. And so if they want more people to have more jobs as a result of economic growth, then they will grab this. I just think that numbers that are that big, $5.5 trillion over 10 years, that won't be scored appropriately by the Congressional Budget Office. We saw in the American Healthcare Act that that did have an effect. Right. It did not pass in the end, either because to fix the CBO numbers or at least address the issues raised by the CBO, things were put in the bill or kept in the bill that caused the Freedom Caucus to bolt, but also because you had moderates bolt as well. And that's what ultimately meant they couldn't get the votes for it. So if those forces are still in play, then I don't think it will go forward. I think also it has to be the tax cut conversation has to happen in the context of a larger budget. The budget has to be cut by Congress, and that is specific programs. That means we could have a conversation about Medicare premium support in the House as a way to make up some of the money that would disappear as a result of this tax cut. Or we could talk about deductions that somebody might introduce in the Senate or House that would create a debate where you're not just talking about a tax cut, but you're talking about the spending reductions you'd have to offset it with. And those can sometimes be quite popular and cause issues. So, you know, there's a reason its tax policy is hard to do. And I think those reasons will assert themselves again.
There's a great piece, I don't know if you guys read, by Tyler Cowen.
Yeah, that was interesting. Talk about that.
So Tyler, who's, you know, just about the most brilliant person there is, made the point that liberals for the last 8 years have been clamoring for huge deficit spending on to fund infrastructure, to invest, for the government to invest and do things like build roads and build energy grids and take advantage of historically low interest rates to borrow money and stimulate the economy with government deficits. Cowen says, all of you liberals who are now complaining, well, this tax bill will balloon the deficit, this is just essentially a private sector version of what Democrats have been clamoring for. The theory is that if you cut the corporate tax rate, corporations are going to have all this extra money, these extra profits. They're going to invest that money in R&D, in jobs, in new factories, and you get the stimulative benefits, except it's done through the private sector that Democrats wanted to do through the public sector. And therefore, you shouldn't be so immediately negative and sort of cawing endlessly about the deficit effects of it, because in fact, you may get the right kind of stimulation. I would argue that actually the reason liberals wanted investment in infrastructure is that there's certain kinds of things only the government can do, and certain kinds of things where the United States is falling behind because the government isn't doing them. And that's why you want this to be government spending rather than private sector. But it was a very good point by Tyler.
Wait, isn't there? I agree with you, David, but I also had another question, which is that. So and we should also say Cowen includes a couple of caveats. Most importantly, this rather technical but I think huge loophole question, which is whether pass-through companies, which are when you just set up a corporation essentially to pay yourself, like suddenly I'm Emily Bazelon Incorporated and my salary goes there and then I pay a 15% corporate tax rate.
Right.
If all that would be a huge loophole, like I said, and so Cowen says, well, you need to make sure to close that loophole or this theory falls. But the other thing that I was confused about is, isn't the whole idea of the Laffer curve that these tax cuts are going to pay for themselves because we're going to stimulate the economy. And we have seen that not work repeatedly with Reagan tax cuts, with Bush tax cuts. I wasn't really sure. I mean, I guess the added layer from Cowen is the idea that if you think we can afford a billion on infrastructure, then we can afford a huge tax break in the sense that it's okay to blow up the deficit.
Right, it's a deficit.
Right.
It's a Keynesian. It's like a supply side Keynesian.
It's a Keynesian, exactly. Yeah. But I just want to to finish. It doesn't mean that the Laffer curve is suddenly true. It means that you have this huge deficit.
He's not
and
bothering.
That's okay.
He's not bothering with the Laffer curve. He's doing what you're saying, which is like the deficit is no longer a part of this conversation because you liberals haven't cared about the deficit for a long time. So don't suddenly get all puritanical on the deficit when you didn't care about it. Also, by the way, we think of Laffer curve and Reagan, but having spent some time with Kennedy, they believed all this stuff too, that a massive tax cut was the, in 1962, was the way to restart the economy. I think the only problem, and what Cowen says is exactly right about the differing ideologies. I think the one thing that is yet then unresolved, though, is that if Democrats have to drop their sudden interest in the deficit and debt, then Republicans have to wrestle with their longtime obsession with same, which they would have to put aside. And if you're constantly putting aside the things that you once said were at the center of your belief system.
You'll be a man, my son.
Why are you doing it?
Yeah. Why are you doing it? And then why should we believe anything you say on anything else? And this is obviously true of all politicians, but it's particularly true in this specific case with respect to Republicans who talked about the deficits for so long.
Okay, one final point, which I just forgot to mention, because it was so extraordinary that this came out, just backing up to the healthcare bill. So it appears that in the drafts of the healthcare bill that have been making their way so far, that Congress exempted itself from these provisions, these new provisions, and that Congress essentially put itself, Congress and its employees who are required to be on Obamacare at the moment, it basically said that these rules that would allow states to waive benefits and jack up premiums for people with pre-existing conditions, they wouldn't apply to Congress and its employees. There is no way, John, that they're going to try to put a bill through that does that. Is there? That stupid.
Go ahead, Emily.
They backed off, but I think it's amazing that it was in there in the first place. Just very telling. And it was in there not in a clear way. It did not have like a big bell hanging on it. Tim Jost or Jost, however you say his name, was like a healthcare policy wonk, went in and found it. So, you know, we're talking about an obvious sense of deep doubt that waiving all of these requirements of Obamacare are going to leave people with insurance that's worth having.
And I still don't see the way in which these improvements to the bill, improvements meaning whatever makes it better so that it can get the majority vote in the House, how they address the thing that President Trump was worried about, which is the way this bill affects his voters. It seems to embrace Freedom Caucus theories, which the president may believe in, but which the Congressional Budget Office didn't believe in the first time it did it and ran the numbers on this. And it was the Congressional Budget Office numbers that the president was responding to when he said he would fix the bill to help the poor, rural and old elderly who will be disadvantaged by the rules in the new bill. So there's that wrinkle too.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Aura Frames. Are you looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura Frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It is super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. Aura Frames, in the notes that I have here, says moms like Aura Frames. I'm here to tell you that is like the truest statement in the world. I gave my mother an Aura Frame. She absolutely loves it. She's also always hectoring me to keep adding new photos to her Aura Frame so that she's got great new photos every week. So think about giving your mother or grandmother or aunt or sister or friend an Aura Frame for Mother's Day. It was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's auraframes.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Barack is back. He was at the University of Chicago making his first real public appearance since he left office this week, speaking with a group of young students and community activist types for free, I believe. Then came reports, confirmed reports now, that he agreed to a $400,000 payday for a speech he will give at a healthcare conference in September for Cantor Fitzgerald, a Wall Street investment bank. There has been a huge backlash from a lot of liberals towards this speech. Let's talk about it. John, what is the problem? All former presidents do this. You know, he was an anti-Wall Street, but he also raised a lot of money from Wall Street. He has the right to earn a living. Every other president does this. Clintons have done it a ton. What's one speech, one paycheck? Right. What's the big? And also, we know he's not going to trim his sails for them. He's not going to suddenly tell them he loves their work.
Oh, well, but he's not going to give it to them right in the teeth either.
But what's the problem?
I think the problem, as it's been articulated by the critics, is that there is an imbalance in American life, and he spent some of his presidency, arguably all of his presidency, trying to fix that imbalance, both in specific policy terms and also in the time and attention he paid to the to fixing the balance. And so this speech reinforces the imbalance, and absence him, or he's not taking a stand in a larger public conversation about how totally out of whack things have gotten. CEO pay, money paid to ex-presidents, that he has a symbolic duty here to stay consistent and to practice what he preached, although that may be going too far. But that he has a symbolic opportunity here to say, hey, this is a part of what has gotten our country so out of whack that anybody anywhere could get paid $400,000, or that somebody can basically cash in on their public service and get paid $400,000, and that standing up in that moment would be a way to use his capital to send a larger message that he supposedly believes in. I think that's the argument against.
Emily. That's one of the arguments. I mean, there's also this problem where at a moment where populism is becoming a tool of the right, not just in our country, but internationally, it seems like liberals have a particular stake in differentiating themselves from people who just like buckrake. And President Obama, isn't he still the most popular politician the Democrats have? I mean, it just seems so incredibly hypocritical. Like, what's a word that means more than hypocrisy? Like, self-destructive, just utterly maddening. I can't really express how disappointed and like just disgusted I was by this. Also, the man just signed, I'm sorry, I'm not done ranting. He and Michelle Obama just signed what? A $65 million book contract. Why does this person need $400,000? And if he is going to have the extraordinarily poor judgment as to take that amount of money from Wall Street, he should donate it fast to some real charity, not his library.
Right. I was going to say, what if he gives his money up and gives it to something that, you know,
I don't really think that fixes it, but it would be better than this.
So there was a fantastic Matt Iglesias piece about this, our former Slate colleague, now Vox, Jeannie Matt, who makes the point that the bargain that the kind of left elite, the cosmopolitan elite of the left, of whom Barack Obama is the living embodiment, Hillary Clinton also sort of an embodiment, is that we are going to have capitalism, we're going to have markets with strong, you know, protections, but also we're going to have global trade, and we're all going to benefit in the long run. And that's the kind of principle that we're going to live on. And the bargain that you make with working class and poor and even middle class voters is you say, we're going to self-abnegate a bit. We're going to hold ourselves to a slightly higher standard. We're not going to be corrupt because we understand how hypocritical it looks if we are corrupt. And this perception of corruption has been devastating, Matt points out, to Tony Blair and to Hillary Clinton in particular, these center-left politicians who basically hold the same views that Barack Obama does about all these things. But when voters had the sense that these people were sort of self-dealing and making themselves rich, it really, really hurt their credibility. Whereas people like Donald Trump, it doesn't hurt their credibility because people don't expect any better from them to begin with.
Right. And that may not be fair, but it's a political reality.
And I wonder if you can make the argument that while there is a distinction to be made between people who are running for office and to hold office and whether they should get $400,000 checks for speaking, which is to say the Hillary Clinton example, or whether – so is there a distinction between Hillary Clinton, who wanted an office and was taking this, these speech fees, and President Obama, who never wants another office again? I think you could make the argument that it doesn't matter. That distinction doesn't matter because President Obama drapes his behavior over the entire party in a way
for
that –
For now, yeah.
Yeah.
For now. In 10 years, that might not be true. In 10 years, he may be – 10 years, it might be like, yes, you go take government money from the government of Dubai to give a speech. But right now, he is the
public – I don't think so.
Well, right now, he's – right now,
he's either. But
right
now,
he's the public face. He is the main face. Right. I mean, even Bill Clinton is 20 years after and still matters.
He's supposed to be running some big voter rights drive, too. Like, he is still involved. I also think it's irritating that he's trying to do all these public appearances and never utter the words Donald Trump or talk about what is actually going on in the world. There's, like, an elephant in the middle of the room, and the idea that the former president should have nothing to say about it forever. I just think like he's being too mincing about it.
Well, I think that I don't think he said he's not going to say anything forever. And I think secondly, that you can make a case if you're on his team, I think you can make the case that him saying something and immediately setting himself up as the opponent of the entire right, which he would become, actually creates unity.
Yeah.
Whereas at the moment, there's disunity and destabilization.
Right. Agreed. Okay, I want to throw some things at you. What if it were not Cantor Fitzgerald that he was speaking at, but if it were GE, would it be okay then?
No.
Not
it
at all.
It just would like be slightly a tiny bit less, you know, tarnishing. No, it doesn't matter. You don't buck rake. You don't. It's what John said. It's you did your public service. You take your book contract. There are plenty of more.
What if it were Harvard? What if it were University of Oregon, and it was $50,000?
I mean, I guess I would think the University of Oregon has better things to do with its $50K, honestly. Like, as the University of Oregon is like a funded by the taxpayers. I just think that's bullshit.
The question is, in a time of collapsing norms, who stands — this is true of the president or anybody else — who stands up and, when it's against their self-interest, maintains a norm publicly or privately? Because the both in the culture and certainly with the success of the current president, the encouragement to drop norms for success, either personal success or the success of your team, is huge. I mean, there's a real push to do that. So presumably, if that's something you don't like, which I think is the position that the president holds, then presumably this would be a chance to take a stand for a norm.
Well,
that would be the former
but
president.
It's norm, not a norm. It's not really a norm. It's kind of a, what do you call it? It's not really a norm.
Tradition.
The norm is actually
the norm
is to
take
the
money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Sorry.
It's a principle. How about
principle,
that?
A principle. There you go. There you go. It's definitely not a norm. The norm is you take the money.
Okay, what if it were work? What if he had been hired by GE to we would like him to come and advise us on organizational management and strategic advice, and we'd like to pay you, Mr. President, $500,000 for, you know, for 40 hours of work for us. Would that be okay?
I mean,
I don't know. I don't know. I don't have an answer. Do you have an answer, Emily?
I know. I don't really have an answer either. It depends. Like, does it seem like real work? I mean, Eric Holder is working for Uber right now investigating sexual harassment. I'm assuming he's getting paid. I don't care.
What about the argument?
Speech is not work, in your view.
A speech is not $400,000 worth of work. Are they going to release the transcript at least afterward? I mean, what if this turns into another secret goal? Like,
I'm sure it's a public conference.
But also, it can be secret. He's not running for anything.
No, it can't be. It's gross. It should not be. This is a terrible precedent that he is continuing. These are the last footsteps of Hillary Clinton he should be following.
What about this argument, which is, you know, he served for 8 years. There were lots of constraints on his behavior. It's irrevocably changed his life, and it's changed his life in all kinds of wonderful ways too. But why should he, if he's going to take the downsides — and any public official who does this, by the way, if they're going to have the downsides of public service, 7 days a week and all the rest — why shouldn't he be able to, in the end, to benefit and add on top of that the idea that the old this is the only way you get good people argument, which is isn't the argument
you're so strawmanning up here, John? No, it's so nice.
Come on, I'm trying
Thank
to give you,
you
guys a little
going.
Something.
What
to,
good people? Kinda, yeah, I'm enjoying
to,
this.
On the
what
contrary, when the idea about? When the idea is that the purpose of public office is to give you the chance to cash out later, you will get people whose main goal is to cash out later. That's number one. Number two is, I don't see what the great punishment of public service is. I don't see where it is that he's been suffering so much for 8 years. He's had a job with enormous prestige and responsibility.
Oh, I don't know. Having to choose whether people live or die is probably.
You know what? That is there is a hunger for power and responsibility for among some of us. And I assume that's a
joy.
I don't think it was a hard job.
I'm just making that up.
No, I don't think it was. I don't think it was a unpleasant job for him.
Book contract. How much more? Like how? I guess.
Well, that's about publishing, not about him.
No, but I mean, nobody gave him a hard time, and that is a huge amount of money. How am I supposed to square the principled, honorable, you know, life isn't just about making money, spewing forth of ideas from Barack Obama, lo these long years, with the notion that, like, let's go reach out and grab this $400K because it came my way. It's just, how much money does this person need, and why does he want to send the message that this is the thing that he needs to do for all those years of supposed sacrifice? Like, that just seems so at odds with all of the ideas he shoved at us for a long time.
Also, to be fair, I'm the one who is making the straw man about the trade-off between service, and I don't know that he's actually made that argument or
He's taking the money, so he's responsible for it. Whatever his rationale, I can't come up with a rationale that makes me feel better about it.
So then are you guys saying that presidents who have not taken the huge book contracts and who have quietly gone off and sort of live their life not making buck raking, the sort of Jimmy Carter model, although he may have made money in speeches, but certently not at this level, is the better way to behave?
George H.W. Yes, it is the better way.
Well, George W. and H.W. both made a lot of money from speeches, and they're both very rich men, right?
Well, but I don't know. Did they do something parallel to this?
George H.W. went and gave some $2 million speeches to Japan. But I don't. I think what Jimmy Carter did is absolutely. Yeah, I think what Jimmy Carter did is the embodiment of public service and decency. And honestly, like, do you think that Jimmy Carter is eating cat food? Jimmy Carter is living as rich and happy, but
you're drawing that too extreme. But earlier you were trying to find out what's the line, what's the permissible line. So it's not all the way to cat food; it's somewhere in between. And so did Jimmy Carter find it? Is the question?
Yes.
I don't know. All right.
Yeah, I think Jimmy Carter found it.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
A district court judge in California, William Orrick, stopped and joined an executive order of President Trump's this week. This order was proposing to withhold sort of ill-defined way, various government money to sanctuary jurisdictions that were not cooperating in every possible way with federal immigration policies that the Trump administration and Attorney General Jeff Sessions were pursuing. Emily, what did Orrick rule? Why did he rule it?
Judge Orrick ruled that President Trump does not have the power to take away funds that that Congress already appropriated and gave to cities and states and localities. And there are a few reasons for this. One is that it's been clear for a long time, according to the Supreme Court, I think since the early 80s, that if a law is going to put a lot of conditions on states and cities before they can take money, it has to be really clear about that in the text of the law. These appropriations don't say that. Then the second reason is a case called Prince from, I think, the 90s, because I think I was in law school when it came out, which is near and dear to conservatives. It's like a really important case for preserving the principle of federalism. And the idea in this case is that you can't commandeer local governments into doing the bidding of the federal government. And then the third kind of piece of this puzzle is the Obamacare ruling by the Supreme Court that said that Obamacare couldn't, the Supreme Court used the word coerce, couldn't coerce the states into taking Medicaid funding. Another beloved conservative part of a decision, I should say. And all of these cases add up to the notion that when the federal government says it's going to give money to states and cities, if they want to attach strings, the strings can't like strangle the cities and states, and they also have to be there from the beginning, and the president doesn't get to attach new strings after the fact. I think it's pretty solid.
Separate out for me, Emily, the rebuttal that is then, well, the law is clear. You have to enforce the immigration laws. This is, you know, they're not enforcing the laws. Why isn't that a proper rebuttal to what you're saying?
I think the best argument on the other side is that there is a statute, it's called like 1373, which says that states and cities have to, quote, communicate with ICE. And so there are some states and cities which may be going so far as to essentially block local police departments from communicating about immigrants who they arrest because they don't want to then turn over those immigrants for detention. So I think there's a way in which states and cities can do a lot of what these sanctuary policies call for that don't technically run afoul of that law. And there's like the Office of the Inspector General looked into this. The Obama administration had asked for a review. So there is a limit to what states and cities can do in not cooperating with ICE. But this sanctuary cities taking away funding policy from Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, and from Trump just goes way beyond that. I mean, we really are talking about appropriating local resources to deport people and detain them.
Could you imagine a law, and would it ever pass, where that kind of fixes this problem, which is to say, if a state and local government doesn't enforce a federal statute, then they are in breach or they can be penalized by taking money away from them?
Congress could pass a law. I mean, it's hard to imagine like a blanket law that would take care of all the different appropriations at once. But just imagine that Congress passed that law. There'd be a big challenge from the states under the 10th Amendment. They would say, well, wait a second. We have our own rights. And again, this principle of federalism traditionally has been one that conservatives rather than liberals have super cared about. I mean, going back to the days of states' rights, it doesn't necessarily always have to be an idea that is associated with, you know, not enforcing desegregation, which is when it became really popular. We do in the Constitution have a balance of power that is struck between states, cities, and particularly between states and the national government. And so what we're seeing here is a president who is frustrated about one particular aspect of how Democratic cities are dealing with immigration, trying to be very heavy-handed in taking more power for himself.
I would just caution, you're laying out of the legal arguments against this executive order is very persuasive, Emily, and I'm sure you're right. But just, you know, liberals need to be careful, because when you start to align yourself too much on the side of states' rights and against the power of the federal government to coerce and pressure behavior in jurisdictions, it takes liberals places they generally don't want to end up. Like liberals,
but why do you think that's generally true at this point, as opposed to just sometimes true?
Well, I think because generally the more progressive power, or rather the most regressive activity in the United States, comes from state and local governments in red states, and then again the most progressive activity tends to come from state and local governments in blue states, like on policing, on imprisonment, on housing policy, on healthcare policy, on building infrastructure, where red states are doing things which are very bad for those individual citizens of that state and very bad for the kind of whole nation, the fabric of the nation as a whole, and where you want there to be federal protections for those citizens. And the more we sort of line up ourselves with the idea, well, states do what they want, the less sort of national standards there are. And I'm somebody who believes that this country needs more national standards, not fewer, and more national authority over these issues rather than less.
But even if you are that person, what you're now veering into in terms of just like legal standards is called preemption. It's about whether national laws can preempt the states from making laws. That's like a different line. I mean, I know I'm being a little technical here, but that's a different line of doctrine from we offer you this money, but only if you do what we say on X, Y, and Z. And so the whole question of when national laws can preempt state laws, that's going to like continue to be debated. And many of those standards will be upheld, whether or not the Trump administration can take away money for, you know, the COPS program, which is community policing, from the state of California and the city of New York.
Yeah, I think you're right. They can't and they shouldn't in this case. I just worry about when liberals get excited about federalism, my antennae go up, because that's not been a healthy place for them for most of the past century.
But see, I feel like you're being too nervous about the history, because federalism itself is not a reactionary principle. I mean, it certainly has had that history, but that doesn't mean it can't also be have a progressive element to it.
Well, it's the tool of the party out of power. So when a Texas court judge blocks an immigration plan from Obama, it's serving the same purpose that this San Francisco judge is serving, right?
Right. I mean, yes. And it's also the tool of trying to use the states as a laboratory of democracy and show what good policies can do for people as well as bad. I mean, I would certainly make an argument that we are more and more living in a world in which the blue states are just different to live in from the red states. I mean, this goes back to our previous discussion about healthcare and state waivers. I mean, it already is different in terms of the social benefits you get where you live. The Trump era looks like it's going to make that even more the case. And that may be deeply troubling. But we do have freedom of travel and movement in the country. And so at least people aren't totally stuck. At least they're not stuck by law in places that are or may be worse to live in.
When you say, well, every state is its own special flower, you know, you can choose whether to live in a tulip or live in a rose, and it's just your choice. That's not really the case.
Or a thorn bush.
That's not really the case. It's the case is that states are different, and some of that patchwork nature is intrinsic to the federalist system, and some of it we value. But we are reaching the I think we're stretching that to a dangerous point. We're stretching it when we get states that are as different and treat people as differently as we've gotten. And I think one of the reasons is that the idea of federalism is a reigning idea. It's a triumphant idea. And liberals, and we saw this around gay marriage and marriage equality, you know, there was some argument which is let's make this a state-by-state case and win it gradually. But they're pretty happy when it happened as a became a national standard because of the Supreme Court. I just this is not me arguing any particular issue.
It depends
issue.
What the floor
I just
is,
caution
right?
that like that when you say this is a state by state, city by city situation, and the federal government shouldn't be setting standards, whether it's for education or healthcare, you end up in a place that you don't want to be.
Well, I didn't say that. But I think also it depends what the floor is. If you're talking about states being able to raise the ceiling and then setting some shining example, in whatever capacity you imagine that to be, maybe it has to do with conceal and carry gun laws if you think that's a good idea. That's one thing. And then it's different to say that there are basic standards, whatever we decide those are, of kind of decency of people's lives that states are falling beneath. I mean, that might be the fear, for example, with the new healthcare law. So I just think it depends what we're talking about. And I also, you have to recognize the democratic element of this, too. I mean, if you think red state policies are ill serving the people who live in them, well, those voters are voting for Republicans who are dominating their state houses and their governor's mansions. So therein lies a conundrum.
That's true.
And that's where it's on Democrats to be doing more to run for office and engage, et cetera. But there anyway.
Hey, just quickly, Emily, where does this possibly go? Orrick has said basically if Congress wanted to do this, it would have told you to. So it's a balance of powers question. So where does it go now? It goes to the Ninth Circuit and gets argued.
The Ninth Circuit.
Yeah. Just to answer that quickly, and also this idea of breaking up the Ninth Circuit, which the president said he supports and will do.
Yeah, the president has no power to break up the Ninth Circuit. That's not how it works. The Ninth Circuit's really big. It covers a whole bunch of states, plus like Guam and the Virgin Islands. It's and, you know, Yeah, it's really big territorially. It has the most judges. There are like perfectly sensible reasons to talk about breaking up the Ninth Circuit, but Trump can't do it. And also, when you talk about breaking it up for political reasons because you think there are too many Democrats dominating the court, that's different from saying that it's like dysfunctional as a matter of, you know, too much traveling and just too big a territory. Yeah, so that's where the case is going. There's another lawsuit in Massachusetts that's coming up. There'll be other sanctuary city lawsuits, and this could go up to the Supreme Court. I mean, that's what Trump said it was going. We'll see if they really want to fight it that far.
Okay, let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are, I don't know, what season of cocktail is it now? It's probably the Kentucky Derby. It's always about to be the Kentucky Derby. So it's probably whatever.
Mint juleps.
When you're mint juleping on the back porch of Dickerson Manor, John, what will you be chattering about?
I guess I'll be chattering about the 130,000-year-old mastodon, which was found,
you and I are going to have a fight about this, but go ahead.
Which was found in San Diego near a freeway. So in 1993, a backhoe operator found this fossil. And what's interesting to me about this story is that it's basically a mystery. So anyway, they found this fossil, they dated the fossil, and then they found that next to the fossil, there were human tools. And
They found some rocks.
David, this is my chatter. Don't be the jerk at the cocktail party. Be the nice person who wants to be invited back to the cocktail party. Anyway, now he's claiming he's the host of the show.
It used to be
that they claimed we were co-hosts. But now,
I'm one of the hosts.
Into a corner, he claims that he is the host. And bring me some strawberries. Somebody bring me some strawberries. Anyway, so the claim in the Journal of Nature is that these tools that were found were 130,000 years old, which would be about 100,000 years older than people guessed humans were in North America. Now, there is considerable controversy about this. One is in the dating used for the original mastodon bones, and the Wired has a great article about the various different ways you can date things and why it doesn't work so well in some cases and others, which is very cool. Then the other big debate is whether these are tools at all, and there seems to be some evidence from the bones themselves that they were broken by tools. But then secondly, whether those tools were used by humans and then in the same time frame as the mastodon died. And so there is a great roiling debate going on among paleontologists and I suppose also anthropologists about whether this changes history in this huge swerving kind of way, or whether it's just a story of how sort of imprecise these kinds of measurements can be and how much a lot of this, like in, say, physics, is based on kind of assumptions and groping rather than certainty.
Well, and also, I mean, just to add 2 points, one, detective work is extraordinary because their claim is that the way the bones were broken, they've had people try to break modern elephant bones, and the elephant bones broke in a similar way if you were attacking them with tools to try to get the marrow out.
Right.
And that's a theory about why the bones would be broken in this particular way rather than other ways. The other thing is that – so let's say they confirm that this is 130,000 years old and it was in fact broken by some human person. It wouldn't have been a Homo sapiens because it wouldn't have been us because there's – The people who became us came out of Africa 50 to 80,000 years ago. So whoever was there 130,000 years ago would have been some Neanderthals, the Decevonians, I can't remember how you pronounce them, somebody who's not our ancestors. So what happened to them? Who were they?
Right. That's why this is interesting and worthy of cocktail chatter.
Yeah, that makes it cooler.
It's definitely worthy of cocktail chatter.
Cocktail argument.
That's the best kind of cocktail chatter. Emily. What's your mastodon?
I am super excited about a new book called Awakening by my dear friend Nathaniel Frank. It's about how the gay marriage movement succeeded, and it's very much written from the perspective of the gay rights movement, as opposed to some previous books which have gotten a lot of attention and have been, I would say, over enamored of the role that some lawyers outside of the gay rights movement played. This is really... addressing the questions, David, you were just flicking at earlier. How did this movement succeed? How much was it about building grassroots support state by state? How much was it about using the courts? And it's just like a really gripping narrative. Nathaniel's really managed to pull that off. So Awakening, check it out. I really recommend it.
So I have two chatters. First of all, just a quick reminder, chatter, that next Saturday, May 6th, the Obscura Day, Atlas Obscura's holiday of exploration. It's your day to get out. We have 175 events going on all over the world, probably near you. If you go to atlasobscura.com/obscuraday, it's a chance to get out and see something strange and wonderful and weird near you and make your world a bigger place. So check out atlasobscura.com/obscuraday to find something amazing to do. My other chatter is something actually one of my colleagues at Atlas Obscura, in fact, just emailed around and was so extraordinary that I thought, why not? Let me chatter about it. So, John, this is very much in your vein. I'm not sure where Eric drew this from, but the book it comes from is The Brief History of the United States Patent Office from its Foundation by R. Beresford, and it describes an incident during the War of 1812. During the burning of Washington, the War of 1812, when a British expeditionary force leveled a cannon at the patent office, the superintendent of the patent office, William Thornton, put himself before the gun and in a frenzy of excitement exclaimed, "Are you Englishmen or only Goths and Vandals? This is the patent office, a depository of the ingenuity of the American nation in which the whole civilized world is interested in. Would you destroy it? If so, fire away and let the charge pass through my body." The effect is said to have been magical upon the soldiers and to have saved the patent office from destruction. When the smoke cleared from the dreadful attack, the patent office was the only government building left untouched.
That is excellent.
That's amazing.
Our interns, Kevin Townsend, our producers, Jocelyn Frank. Steve Lichtai is executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Andy Bowers is chief content officer for Panoply. We're part of the Panoply Network, and our entire roster of podcasts is at panoply.fm. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest, and our email address is gabfest@slate.com. Don't forget our live shows May 10th in Washington, D.C., and June 7th. In Denver, Colorado. You can get tickets to those at slate.com/live. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I am David Plotz. Talk to you next week.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.